This is a reading of a cycle of lectures by Rudolf Steiner entitled Becoming the Archangel Michael's Companions, Rudolf Steiner's Challenge to the Younger Generation. This is Lecture 8, given in Stuttgart on October 10, 1922. Up to now, we have given an outer description of what was experienced by those growing up around the turn of the 19th century, by considering the trend of human spiritual culture. Today, in order to find the transition to a true self-knowledge, we will study the human being from within. When we consider spiritual evolution outwardly, especially in the West, we are led back to the first third of the 15th century. For an inward study, we must go back to the 4th century BCE. A date indicating an important moment would be the year 333 CE. Yet this date is, of course, only approximate. It is not a date from which to make calculations. It serves as an approximation in pointing to weighty matters affecting a large proportion of European humanity. Let us look into the soul of a person who before this date lived into the culture of Southern Europe or in certain districts of Northern Africa. These districts are the prominent ones to be considered when we try to gain an idea of the definitive cultural life of the time. The souls of these human beings still were conscious that human thought was not simply worked out in the head, but that it was revealed either directly to the individual, or where the human being was not able to receive such revelation directly, through the confident communication of other human beings. The prevalent feeling among the educated and uneducated today that their thoughts are worked out in their own head did not exist then. It was a period of actual transition. In the Middle East, outstanding spiritual personalities were concerned with how thoughts came to humanity from spiritual realms. In Southern Europe and in Northern Africa, doubts began to creep in as to whether the human being possessed the faculty to receive thoughts by revelation. These doubts were only faint at first. There was still an overwhelming feeling. When I have a thought, this thought has been put into me by a god, either indirectly or transmitted by way of human heredity, that is, through tradition, not natural heredity. Thought can enter earthly evolution only as revelation. The first Westerners to feel strong doubts in this direction were those who had come from the northern peoples and entered the civilization of the south. They were of Germanic Celtic blood, and had moved with the various migrations from the north to the south. These people probably would have reached the point, out of their own nature, of saying, thoughts are something we work out for ourselves. This feeling, however, was dulled down by what they found as the Greco-Latin culture, as the culture of the East. These cultures were extraordinarily intermixed by the fourth century. Every possible trend was working within them. Yet in the migrations southward, one felt strongly that thoughts were grasped only by drawing them into the world of the senses from a supersensible world. We have only an external history. We have no history of feeling, no history of thought, no history of the soul. Hence, we were not made aware how the whole disposition of the soul changed from one century to another. There was a tremendous change in inner human perception precisely in the 4th century CE. We find then something that for the very first time caused people to reflect upon the origin of thought. What previously had been accepted without question, namely the fact that thoughts were revealed, gradually came to a point where a theory was needed in order for people to understand it. But these people were by no means convinced that human beings could create their thought world out of themselves. Consider the great difference in this connection between souls of the present day and souls of that time. I am speaking of some souls only. What I am describing to you was naturally present in the most varied nuances. For one part of humanity, matters were as I have described them. For another, there was still an invincibly strong, intense belief that souls, spiritual beings, descended into the human organism and communicated thoughts. It was, to an extent, an, in quotes, elite of humanity, who at that time grasped thought in such a way that the question could arise, where do thoughts come from? For the others, it was quite evident that thoughts were given. Now take the souls born after the year 333 approximately. These souls were no longer able, out of a natural feeling, to give a matter-of-course explanation of the origin of thought. Thus a period followed in which theorists, philosophers, and philosophical theologians wrestled with the question of the significance of thoughts in the world. Then arose the struggle between nominalism and realism. The nominalists were those in the Middle Ages who said thoughts live only in the human individuality. They are only a summary of what exists outside in the world and within separate individuals. The realists still had a vivid recollection of those ancient times when people regarded thoughts as having substance, as something substantial that was revealed. They conceived thoughts in such a way that they said, "It is not I who think the thought. It is not I who, for instance, sum up all dogs into the general concept dog. There exists one general thought, dog, and this is revealed out of the spiritual world, just as a color or tone is revealed to the senses." It was a struggle to understand rightly the nature of thought that had, as it were, alighted as an independent possession in the human soul. It is of extraordinary interest to steep oneself, from this point of view, in the spiritual history of the Middle Ages. The closer we come to the 15th century, the more we see with what intensity human beings struggle to come to terms with what is revealed through thought in human nature. Whereas human beings, before the year 333, really had the idea, there is a divine weaving streaming around the earth, just as in the physical world the atmosphere streams round it, and in this streaming, beings, the thoughts, remain behind and reveal themselves to human beings. They are, so to speak, the footprints of the divine world surrounding the earth, which are buried in human beings as thoughts. Whereas those souls who before the year 333 considered that in the thought world a feeling of their connection with the spiritual world existed, we find the Middle Ages permeated by the tragedy of still seeking to connect thought in some way with the divine spiritual. Why did those souls, who up into the 15th century thought about thoughts, if I may put it so, strive so vigorously to connect thoughts with what is divine spiritual in the cosmos? It was because they felt an inner impulse, which they were unable to express in clear concepts, but which was present in them as a definite soul experience. This originated from all the souls who were born as the leading souls of humanity from the 4th to the 14th century, who were reincarnated from the time long before the year 333, and who argued energetically over the reality or merely nominal character of concepts, having lived previously at the time of the mystery of Golgotha. The mystery of Golgotha took place in comparative isolation in the Middle East, but that was only the external manifestation of a spiritual event that took place in the physical world. Something happened in the souls who had reached a certain degree of maturity. When we consider those actually fighting over the reality or unreality of thoughts, we find souls whose previous incarnation had taken place during the first 3 centuries BCE. Essentially, however, civilized humanity was made up of souls reincarnated from the time before the mystery of Golgotha. Out of the real connection between the human soul and the divine spiritual world, which expressed itself in the acceptance of thought being received through revelation, out of this experience, which souls living in the Middle Ages had had in an earlier earthly life many centuries before, arose the impulse to dispute about the reality or unreality of the thought world. For what is it that is known as scholasticism at the beginning of the new era in the 13th, 14th, 15th centuries? What actually filled the souls of the scholastics? It is the fact that a decisive moment had arrived in the evolution of humanity. It was not given utterance, but was felt by outstanding souls of that time. For them it was as if the gods had forsaken the sphere of human thought, as if humans only had thoughts that were wrung dry. When we observe the souls who lived from the 15th century on into later times, we find them to be those who, in their previous incarnation, had lived not long after the year 333. Up to the 8th, 9th centuries CE, at least those who were teachers, still had the feeling that human thought was a gift of the gods. And the people who in their previous earthly life had already felt the world of thought to be forsaken by the gods were, naturally I am speaking only of a part of humanity, destined to be born again about the turn of the 19th and 20th century. When, therefore, we observe not only external destiny, but the inner destiny of the human soul, we must pay no heed to what wells up out of our childhood from the depths of the soul. We must look to the time in which souls were incarnated who could no longer hear from their teachers that thoughts were beings permeated, imbued by the divine. Thereby the inner feeling arose to flee from thought, and that something warmer, more saturated with substance, should be found. This arose because already in a previous incarnation, the divine character of thought had become subject to the gravest doubts, or had indeed been entirely lost. What thus shines through now, out of the previous earthly life, was experienced with the greatest intensity as tragedy at the turn of the 19th century. Since the first third of the 15th century, the receiving of thought from the divine spiritual world was already lost to humanity. Because human beings could no longer receive thoughts out of the divine spiritual world, they took them from outer observation. External observation and the art of experimenting reached such a height because the inner conceiving of thoughts was replaced by gleaning them from the external sense world. In the development of world history, however, what is not dependent on outer circumstances does not immediately become apparent. For even if since the 15th century human beings had lost the ability to conceive thought from within outward, to receive thoughts from the divine spiritual world, those souls were not yet there who could have sensed the full tragedy of being forsaken by revealed thought. In those souls who had lived their former life on earth before the 6th or 7th century, namely, before the 4th century after Christ, there lived in their feeling, we must admit that we receive our thoughts from the external world, but in spite of this, our soul tells us that even the thoughts received from the external world are God-given. We no longer know how one experiences them as God-given, but our inner being tells us that this is so. A truly brilliant spirit who had such a mood of soul was Johannes Kepler. Johannes Kepler was as much a natural scientist of an earlier time as of the later one. He drew his thoughts from external observation, but in his inner experience he had absolutely the feeling that divine beings are there when human beings receive thoughts from nature. Kepler felt himself to be partly an initiate, and for him it was a matter of course that he experienced his abstract building up of the universe artistically. It is extraordinarily valuable, from a scientific point of view, to immerse oneself in the progress human thought has made through Kepler. Yet one is more deeply stirred when one steeps oneself in Kepler's life of soul. A soul life of such intensity and inwardness did not exist in any other natural scientist in later times, and certainly not in any authoritative teacher of the majority of humanity. between the 15th and the 19th centuries, the feeling was entirely lost that through thought the human soul is brought into connection with the divine spiritual. Those who do not merely study the course of time in an unimaginative fashion by just taking in the content, but are able to sense something in the course of events, have something peculiar revealed to them. I do not wish here to talk of how Goethe's special way of thinking about nature has become an impossibility for later science. I mean for the external science of the times following his. For this science did not realize where the difference lay between external science and that of Goethe. I do not want to speak about this. You need only look at scientific books of the last third of the 19th century that set the tone for the later mode of thought, such as, for instance, the physiological works of Henle or Burdach, the latter of which belonged absolutely to the first third of the 19th century, even though his work was written somewhat later. And you will note in all of them a different style. There is still something of the spirit which wells up directly out of the soul when, let us say, they speak of the embryo or of the structure of the human brain. There is still something of what has been entirely lost with later scientists. In this connection, it is significant to bring to mind a personality still actively working during the last third of the 19th century. He was already subject to the forces driving out the spirit from science. Nevertheless, he still had the spiritual life in his own soul. I am referring to the anatomist Hertel, who belongs to only the smallest part of the last third of the 19th century, to the last two-thirds. Hertel is spelled H-Y-R-T-L. Try to let the anatomy books of Hertel work upon you. These books are written in the style of later anatomists, but one can see that it was difficult for Hertel. He writes chapter after chapter, always restraining the impulse to allow anything of the soul to flow into his sentences. Occasionally it peeps through in the style, and sometimes even a little in the content. It is as though the iron necessity existed to extinguish the soul spiritual welling up from out of the human being's inner being whenever they wrote about some natural process. Today we can barely imagine what can be experienced when, let us say, we go back from a contemporary anatomical book to Hertel or Burdach. One feels as if something were charged with a certain amount of warmth in comparison to the limited degree of warmth in the scientific feeling of the first third, but particularly to the second third of the 19th century. Certainly at that time, science was not at its zenith. That is only of secondary importance and need not be considered further. I am speaking of what was experienced in science. And about that one can say, we can see from the path taken by the scientist that which spiritual science shows, namely that at the end of the 19th century more and more souls came, in whom there no longer lived, from their previous earthly life, the impulse that thought is God-given. There was no longer even an echo of this. The sense for the individual past earthly life had been lost, yet its echo still lived on long afterward. Thus there were those who had a really living warmth within them, who had not become dried up by the prejudice that in science one must be objective. What we strive for in spiritual science is the truly objective, but not in the scientist's meaning of the word. These souls, not dried up through striving after objectivity, asked, what is in us that is still bound up with the divine spiritual, from which we were torn in our previous earthly incarnation? They did not ask this consciously, but subconsciously. Rising to the surface of consciousness was the feeling that human beings had lost their connection with the divine spiritual world. On the other hand, it is a feeling that humanity dare not lose this connection, for without this consciousness, even if so dim, the soul cannot live. Hence the strong inclination arose toward an indeterminate yearning for the spirit, and at the same time the incapacity to reach it. It is precisely the characteristic of the generation growing up about the turn of the 19th century, and at the beginning of the 20th, that it would ask the older generations, is there even any possibility to discover the spiritual in our earthly surroundings? And the leaders who are asked unconsciously by the youth how they could find the spiritual in nature, how they could find it within human life itself, rejected as unscientific this bringing of the spirit into the consideration of nature and even of human life. Thus, in the second half of the 19th century, a dreadful thing happened. The slogan, quote, psychology, science of the soul without a soul, close quote, arose. I do not attach great importance to the fact that individual philosophers said that we need a science of the soul without soul. What the philosophers say has no great influence, but it is symptomatic of what figures very widely as feeling and of how one deals with the younger generation. True, only a few philosophers actually said we need a psychology without soul. But the whole age says, we older people wish to teach you mineralogy, zoology, botany, biology, anthropology, even history, in a way to make it appear as if at the most there are experiences of the soul, but not a human soul as such. Thus the whole world, insofar as it is observed scientifically, had to be experienced as having no soul. Those who were first to bring with them out of their previous earthly life this tragedy of experiencing soullessness were compelled to ask with the utmost insistence, where can we look to fill the soul with spirit? And from what their age considered of greatest value, in other respects rightly so, they gleaned the least information. Those who, in the last third of the 19th century, wrote books in such a way that one can gather something of the nature of their soul life from them, were naturally, even in the 19th century, a vanishing minority. I can assure you that in general, the people who wrote these books were not the most brilliant. Among those who do not write books, there are people who are distinctly more intelligent than among those who do write them. In the last third of the 19th century, profounder natures were living in the midst of the superficial ones, content with a science bereft of spirit. And when one looks into the more profound natures of that time, which is possible through spiritual science, one finds a certain wrestling with deep problems. However, those who had this inner life were no longer listened to. They no longer found the opportunity to become leaders. Many people foresaw clearly what the microscope was bringing in its wake in the second half of the 19th century. There were souls among them who participated in the cultural life, but did not really penetrate it, because they could not handle a culture devoid of spirit. Therefore they became silent, even in their thoughts, in face of the scientific views. Yet they felt the question in their depths. How can the microscopic evolution be brought into relation with macrocosmic evolution? They faced this problem increasingly in their feeling life. There were also people who, as a result of their education, followed the scientific tradition and hoped for ever more scientific results from the further development of the microscope. However, others of a deeper nature looked with disturbed feelings upon the further development of the microscope, particularly upon the views that arose as a result. The highest hope of one group was, by examining ever smaller and smaller objects, to penetrate into the nature of what is living. But others felt that this whole business would make the world go under. Yes, there were those who felt the use of the microscope to be a sucking dry of the soul. I trust you will not think that I am indulging in satire in a mystical, fantastic fashion on the use of the microscope. That would never occur to me. I am naturally fully aware of the services rendered by the microscope, and I would never wish to turn the wheels of science back. I am, however, stating facts about the life of the soul. The number of these solitary spirits steadily decreased. Fortlage, who lived as professor in Jena at the end of the 19th century, was one of them. He spoke somewhat as follows. One can look more and more thoroughly into the microscope and go on discovering ever smaller things, But in this minuteness, one loses what is substantially true. And if you want to see what is being sought with the aid of the microscope, then turn your gaze out into the infinite space of the universe. From the stars, there speaks what you are seeking within the microcosm. You talk of the secrets of life and seek for them in what is ever more and more minute. But there one loses life, not for reality, but for knowledge. You can find it again when you understand how to read the stars. Some have said, life is brought down from the cosmos, but they sought for a material means, possibly in the meteor showers flying through cosmic space and bringing the germs and seeds of life out of other worlds down to the earth. But when one gazes from the earth out into limitless space, it is not limitless at all. For the mechanistic, mathematical way of perception, the firmament was done away with by Giordano Bruno. But for the inner contemplation, it is again there, in the sense that one cannot simply draw a radius from the earth and prolong it into infinity. This radius has, in fact, an end, and at this end there is everywhere, at the inner periphery, life to be found and not death. From this world periphery, life radiates in from everywhere. I only wish to indicate to you by these examples the nature of those inner problems of feeling that confronted the soul at the turn of the 19th century. Out of the soul's dullest feeling, the question really was put, where can we rediscover the spiritual? You see, this question must set the mood if any phase of the youth movement is to find a right content. Where can I find the spiritual? How does one experience the spiritual? The really important thing is that side by side with all yearning expectation, there shall also be found among the young single ideals striving toward an inner activity of the soul. I should like to preface what I have to say tomorrow by the following. In what I have named Anthroposophy, in fact in the foreword to my title Intuitive Thinking as a Spiritual Path, a side also known as the philosophy of freedom, and also as the philosophy of spiritual activity, end of aside, you will meet with something that you will not be able to comprehend if you give yourself up only to the passive thinking so specially loved today, to that popular God-forsaken thinking that was already God-forsaken in the previous incarnation. You will only understand it if you develop in freedom the inner impulse to bring activity into your thinking. You will never get on with spiritual science if that spark, that lightning, through which activity in thinking is awakened, does not flash up. Through this activity, we must reconquer the divine nature of thinking. Anthroposophical literature demands that one shall think actively. Most people are only able to think passively and believe that active thinking is impossible. But active thinking does not allow sleeping nor intellectual dreaming. One must keep in step with it and get one's thinking on the move. The moment thinking is set in motion, one keeps up with it. Then what I should like to call modern clairvoyance ceases to be anything miraculous. That this clairvoyance should still appear as something particularly miraculous comes from people not wishing to develop the energy to bring activity into their thinking. It often drives one to despair. One often feels, when demanding active thinking of human beings, that their mood is like the following. A man was lying in a ditch, without moving hand or foot, not even opening his eyes. He was asked by a passerby, "Why are you so sad?" The man answered, "Because I don't want to do anything." The questioner was astonished at this, for the man lying there was doing nothing and had apparently done nothing for a long time. But he wanted to do even more doing nothing. Then the questioner said, "Well, you certainly are doing nothing," and got the answer, "I have to resolve with the earth, and even that I don't want to do." Excuse me. He said, "I have to revolve with the earth, and even that I don't want to do." This is how people appear who do not wish to bring activity into thinking. The power that alone can bring back out of the human being a connection between the human soul and the divine spiritual content of the world again. Many of you have learned to despise thinking because it has met you only in its passive form. This, however, is only head thinking, in which the heart plays no part. But try for once really to think actively, and you will see how the heart is then engaged. Human beings of our age enter with the greatest intensity into the spiritual world if they succeed in developing active thinking. For through active thinking we are able to bring hearty, courageous forces into our thinking again. If you do not seek the Spirit on the path of thought, that, although difficult to tread, must be trodden with courage, if you do not seek through the path of thinking the spiritual life that has flowed through humanity from the very beginning, then you are like infants who believe themselves able to draw nourishment out of themselves and not from the mother's breast. You only come to a movement with real content when you find the secret of developing within yourselves an activity which enables you to draw again out of cosmic life true spiritual nourishment, true spiritual drink. But that is preeminently a problem of the will, a problem of the will experienced through feeling. Infinitely much depends today upon goodwill, upon an energetic willing. And no theories can solve what we are seeking today. Courageous, strong will alone can bring the solution. Let us devote the next few days to the question of how to find this goodwill, this strong will. The end of Lecture 8.